Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
And welcome back to the world of Kabbalah, to Lesson 5, The Great Concealment. Ooh, are we in for a good one tonight? But, with all the positive developments since last Monday, since we were last together, we still have a lot to pray for. So I'm going to recite a short chapter of Psalms for the hostages to all be returned, men, women, and children, safe and sound to their loved ones, to their families, for the success of all the members of the IDF when they do get back to their mission, hopefully very soon, and for safety and security for all the Jews in Israel and all Jews around the world. How about today? I'll read it word for word, or two words at a time, and you'll feel free to say after me, okay? We're Psalm 121, Shir Lama'alot, Esa Einai, El Heharim, Me'ayin, Yavo Ezri, Ezri, Me'im Adonai, Osei, Shamayim, Va'aretz, Al Yitain, Lamot Raglecha, Al Yanum Shomrecha. Hine Lo Yanum Velo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Adonai Shomrecha. Adonai Tzilcha. Al Yad Yeminecha. Yomam Hashemesh. Lo Yakeka. V'yareach ba'loila Adonai yishmarcha mikol ra yishmor et nafshecha Adonai yishmor tzeischa uvo'echa me'ata v'yad olam. The Lord will guard your going and your coming from now and for all time. So with that, let's, great to see everybody. Hope everyone had a nice Thanksgiving, whether you spent it here or somewhere else, with family, with friends, on your own. I'm sure it was wonderful. So glad to be back here for lesson 5. We only have one more lesson after this one. It's getting sad. But we're going to make the best out of it, and we're going to have a lot of fun. So, just by the way, and I'm not sure how many of you are active on what's called the WhatsApp. I know maybe some of you are, but I did create a chat for this course specifically. So I know I emailed the recaps, but I posted them there as well. Also the link to the recordings I posted there. If anyone has a question or a discussion about this course, feel free to bring it up there, and we can address questions there too. So if you're on WhatsApp, or if you want to be on WhatsApp and you're not yet in the chat, let me know after the class and I will include you. All right. WhatsApp is the name of an app. It's a communication app. It's very, very good for group chat. It's very conducive for group chats. It's very popular in the religious Jewish community. For families, for communities, for everything that you could think of. Anyway. So, super excited for today's class, today's discussion. We're going to be discussing one of the biggest topics within Kabbalah, but we're not only going to explore the idea and the concept itself, we're also going to discover some super important and significant life-enriching ideas and lessons from this idea that we're going to be discussing. Just in advance of what we're going to discuss, at the end, and we'll revisit this, but just putting it out there in the beginning, we're going to discover everyone goes through challenges in one way or another. We're going to figure out tonight how do we ensure that we don't crumble in the face of adversity. That's on a personal level. But we're going to discover this from our study, our learning, and our exploration of tonight's big Kabbalistic idea, which is the idea of Tzimtzum. Okay, you're going to hear a lot about that word tonight. Okay? Say after me, Tzimtzum. Okay. But first, if you want, you can take a look at your maps just to refresh very briefly of where we've been from lesson 1 to lesson 4. We, of course, started from the bottom of this edifice that we've been constructing, known in Kabbalistic works as Hishtalshalut, the whole chain-like system of devolution from God until us. And tonight is a key fundamental idea in this transition from God to us, which we're going to come back to shortly. But just very briefly, we started from the bottom. Remember that we dwell in the world of Asiya. Asiya means action, the world of action. But within that world is one of three worlds. We're in the lowest of the three, but that whole three is like one group. We talked a lot about it. They're called Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. Asiya is the lowest. We call them Bia, as an easy acronym for reference. And that we discussed in lesson one, which basically meant and referred to otherness and independence from God. These three worlds are the beginning of independence. That's where creation begins. Then in lesson two, we went another step higher. We went to the world of Atzilut. And Atzilut is the world where we have those emanations from God, where we have those 10 faculties, 10 attributes, or 10 lights and vessels, as we discussed last week. That is emanation, not yet independence. That world of Atzilut is super godly. Is everything about it is godly, but it's where God emanates in specific terms, in 10 specific terms. Then in lesson three, we spoke about, we talked about in what's known as Keter on the divine side, what's known as our willpower and desire on the human side, and the power of it and how it has the ability to drive everything else about us. If we have nothing else going, but we have the will, when there's a will, there's a way. That was lesson three. In lesson four, last week, we spoke about the world of Tohu, the world of chaos, which comes before, precedes the world of Tikkun, the functional world that we are in. Before that came a world of chaos. And in this world of chaos, in very brief, that the problem, the dysfunctionality was that the lights and the vessels were not aligning with each other. And the lights were wanting to just be subsumed in their source. The vessels had no interest in this shidduch that they were set up with the lights. And therefore, there was what we call in Kabbalistic terms, a shattering of the vessels. And the lights kind of returned to their source, to the illuminator, to God and his infinity. That was, in short, what we discussed last week. Of course, in the world of Tikkun, where we are, both the lights and the vessels acknowledge what their real purpose and mission is, of why they exist, and therefore, that purpose drives the fact that they paired themselves together, lights and vessels, to create this sense of functionality and serve in their roles as the 10 faculties within the world of Atzilut. That's just basically where we were up until now. So again, we're comfortable with the ideas. But now we're going to ask a very important fundamental question. And tonight we're going to be talking about how did this shift happen? We just talked about the fact that there was infinity, there's God, and God's infinite light. Before you know it, we're talking about us. So we're left with a big question. We discussed a lot of these big ideas and these various worlds, but there's still a key question. How did we go and transition from the infinite to the finite? That is the driving question today. How did we go from the infinite to the finite? Because it's not just your typical transition. You can't just go like somebody's matures from childhood to a young adult. So that's like That just happens. That's like seamless. It's not always super seamless, but it just happens. You don't need to do anything radical. You just have to live life and hopefully be educated in a good environment, and it just happens. What we're talking about today is something that isn't just seamless. Seamless is when you are walking up the steps. You go from one step to the next step. When you go from one rung on a ladder to the next rung on the ladder, that is a normal transition. The question is, how do you go from infinity to finite? That is not seamless. That's like a radical transition. And we still have to figure out how this happens within this system that we've been discussing. How exactly does that happen? Think of what we now call the United States, or the North American continent, let's say. Think about what it was in 1750 under the British monarchy to what it was in the year 1800, where it was the United States. What happened in between?
Wars.
And how did that start? What initiated it? What's the first thing? Something that's called the shot that was heard around the world, right? So in between North America, as it was in 1750 until 1800, something happened in between. There was a transition. There was a radical shift. There was something that initiated this whole process, which led to it becoming what we know of it today. Similarly, something happened within this system, something radical that set off the entire system to be able to advance to the world of Atzilut, to God's infinity, starting to become finite, and this whole devolution from Atzilut till the next three worlds, until the very world that we are in. So it all devolved, but it had to start from something radical that went from the infinite to the finite. That's what we have to discover. What was that transition? That's exactly what we're going to be focusing on tonight. So, just a very short review of some of the terms that we already discussed, but will be relevant for today. Remember, Or Ein Sof means the infinite light. Or is light, Ein Sof is infinite. Remember that. God's infinity is called Or Ein Sof. The Sefirot, the 10 divine attributes. Remember the term Elokut, which means like godliness, an expression of God. It means not his essential self. Elokut is godliness. It's like God, like the first ish of Judaism, like Jewish. So like God-ish. That's what godliness is. It's not quite God, the essence of God, but it's like of God. That's what Elokut refers to. Then you have Bia, which we just mentioned, the three spiritual worlds of Bria, Yetzirah, and Asiya. And then another term, Yeshut, which refers to existence with self-awareness and independence, usually referred to existence within the three worlds of Bia. So that said, let's talk about the shift. How did this transition take place? What we're looking at here, basically, and you may have already looked at your maps, but right up here. So here are the 10 attributes of Atzilut. This is Keter, where like desire and pleasure dwell. This is what we discussed last week, the world of chaos. And today we're going to climb up even higher to what's called that transition from the infinite to the finite. And we noted that word before, it's called Tzimtzum. That's where it's all at on your map. Right there, to be very specific, it says Tzimtzum HaRishon, which means the first Tzimtzum, because there are others that come after it, but this one is grand, it's the first. And the first is the most radical and the biggest transition. And the word Tzimtzum means like contraction or reduction. And we're going to discuss a lot about this. So, all good so far? Okay. So we're going to read possibly one of the most well-known, maybe even most complex or esoteric texts in Kabbalah. And that's text number one. And This is a teaching from the Arizal, the great Kabbalist from Tzfat, Israel, as recorded by his number one student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. He wrote down the teachings of the Arizal, and this is one of his fundamental ideas that we're going to be exploring tonight. Maybe we'll start on my right side with Phyllis. If you can please read for us, but there's three paragraphs in text one. I'm going to ask you to pause after each one for an intermission.
Okay. Before absolute was emanated and before the creations were created, a simple divine light filled all of reality. It had no aspect of beginning or end. It is called Or Ein Sof, infinite light.
Okay, take a pause. Take a pause. A little breather. We're going to have to take this in bite size. So before Atzilut was emanated, we know what that means, right? We have, this is the world of Atzilut, these 10 faculties. How did it even come about? In other words, this is the first entity that follows the transition. Meaning there's God's infinity and infinite light, and then somehow we get to these 10 specific emanations. That's not infinite anymore, because that has definition. We identify the light of Chachma, the light of Bina, Chesed, Gevura. That's already specific definitions. We're talking about before that, when God is still infinite. So before Atzilut is where God is still infinite. So I'm going to just reread and dwell on it a little bit. Just give me a second, please. So before Atzilut was emanated, and before the creations were created, a simple divine light filled all of reality. When we say simple, we mean undefined. A simple divine light filled all of reality. It had no aspect of beginning or end. It is called Or Ein Sof, the infinite light. So just to sum it up in regular terms, before any world was created, before Atzilut came to be, God's infinite light filled the entire reality. I'm going to use the word space, but I don't really mean physical space. But God's infinite light was everywhere and overwhelmed everything. That was the beginning. Now, next paragraph, please.
When it arose in his will to create the worlds and to emanate absolute, he contracted his infinite light and an empty space emerged.
Okay, but we have a problem now. If God's infinite light fills the entire reality, and he wants to start creating worlds, he wants to put this whole system into action, how do you do that? If God's infinite light fills entire reality, there's no room for anything. Anything that you try to bring in will be totally consumed and overwhelmed by God's infinity. Try like lighting a candle next to the sun. It's absolutely meaningless. It does nothing. You wouldn't even notice it. So you can't bring worlds, especially not the one that we dwell in and live in. You can't bring such a world into a reality where God's infinite light is filling the entire space. It's impossible. So what do? It's infinite, and we're looking. God suddenly has an interest in finite. How do you move forward? That's the second paragraph. So when it arose in his will to create the worlds and to emanate Atzilut, what did he do? He contracted his infinite light. Big words here. He contracted his infinite light. In other words, he decided and figured and concluded that he needs to make space for the worlds and ultimately physical reality, but he needs to make space for it. So he contracted this infinite light and an empty space emerged. And now, there's at least a beginning. We can start having a conversation because he removed his infinite light. What did he do next? But now there's nothing there. So what's the next move?
He then projected downward a single straight line from his circular light, devolving into this empty space. Within this empty space, he emanated, created, fashioned, and made all worlds.
Thank you. So what did he do now that step number one was essential to remove God's infinite light. That needed to be removed from the space, otherwise it's a non-starter. So first, step A, removed it. But in the third paragraph, what does he then do? He then projected downward a single straight line from his circular light. By the way, why do we call it circular? Why do we call God's infinite light circular?
Because it's not beginning or end.
No beginning, no end. That's why we refer to it as circular. We also noted in previous lessons, we called the infinite light Sovev, that it like envelops and like surrounds and hovers from above. We don't mean, again, we don't mean that physically, that it's like over there and not here. We mean that the definition of this light, really non-definition of this light, is that it's infinite. You can't define it, so it's circular. That's why we use that term. But what happened then? He removed that infinite light. Then he projected downward a single straight line from his circular light, devolving into this empty space. Within this empty space, okay, follow the next four terms. You should know exactly what they're referring to. Once he projected that line of divine light, what did he then do? He emanated, what's that a translation of? Which world?
Atzilut
created
Bria,
fashioned Yetzira, and made Asiya. All these worlds were only able to begin coming into being after this process, after this radical shift happened. Now let's unpack this a little bit. So what's that? So when we say straight line, we don't mean that there was physically a straight line. We're saying straight line as opposed to circular. Just like by circular, we don't mean physically circular. We use that term because it has no beginning and no end. So it matches up to infinite light. So after the infinite light was, so to speak, removed, then what he did next was unleash or projected a straight line of divine energy. Using the term line, again, doesn't mean that it looked like a Parker pen. It meant that now it has definition. It has a beginning. A line has a beginning. A line has an end. And it has a specific, let's just say, amount to it. It's very defined. And that's what he unleashed into that space. And with that limited, defined energy, he then went about bringing all the worlds into fruition, starting from Atzilut and devolving to less and less spiritual all the way till this world. But we're going to do more on this. Yes? Okay. So, let's just review this here on the screen so we have it clear. The beginning was that a simple divine light filled all of reality. Okay, there was no beginning and no end. It was just everywhere, infinite light, wherever you turn. And then what happened? There was Tzimtzum. Okay, it's empty. Tzimtzum means, which word do we have here? A disruption happened. Everything was removed. God contracted his infinite light. And we're going to be exploring heavily what that means exactly. What does contracted mean? And then this Tzimtzum, the fact that the infinite light was removed from the scene, this process, the Tzimtzum, enabled a limited projection of godliness afterwards. And with that limited projection, then he was able to start his business of first Atzilut and then the other world. Okay? So far, so good? Please say so, if not. Okay, so obviously, immediately we have a problem here. What's the problem?
Where does it go?
Where does it go?
Where does the contraction go?
Okay, but let's say it had somewhere to go. Maybe he had a closet for it. then it's all good? So, yes, but there's a couple of issues here. Issue number one is as follows. We just said that God's infinite light filled the entire reality, and then we said it was removed from reality. So first of all, we again continuously are reminding ourselves that we can't apply any physical terminology to anything about God, certainly not when we talk about infinity. Maybe in this world we already can, But we can't say that when we talk about God's infinite light. It's impossible. If that's the case, in other words, when you have a cup of water or a cup of tea, and if you're drinking a tea, and you decide, you know what, I don't like this tea anymore. So you have to spill it out. Maybe you even want to rinse out your cup, and then you can take water or juice into the same cup. So that, I understand. If you have one thing in the cup, and you want to make room for something else, so you have to spill it out, clear the glass, make room for something new. But when we're talking about God and reality, what exactly does it mean that God's infinite light is being removed from somewhere? First of all, where is it being removed from? We can't really attach any of these physical terms to God. So everything about this needs to be free of physical connotation. We could say that maybe about Biyah. Being free from physical connotation is true even in the worlds of Biyah. Not in our world, which is the bottom of Biyah, the bottom of Asiya. But in all of Biyah, we can't even use physical connotation. Most certainly not in Atzilut. Most definitely when we talk about Or Ein Sof, which is the infinite light. We can't say anything physical about it. How exactly are we saying that God, like his energy or infinite light, was removed from a certain space? In other words, are we saying that now God isn't in that reality?
Yeah, how does that work?
Are we able to even suggest this? No, we can't. We can't. Okay, but what exactly does that mean? If he's removing himself, then to make space for something else, like the tea and the water, we can't say that about God. We can't say that God isn't here, because there isn't anything that's outside of God. So now we're going to say God's removed from here, and now this world is just devoid of God. But let's just say before the projection of the line, which in Kabbalah is called the Kav. Kav in Hebrew means a line. Before that emanation, let's just say right after the Tzimtzum, what exactly happened? Now God's not there? That's number one. And number two issue is that are we basically saying that there is a space where God's existence is not present anymore?
No.
Right? There's a problem, because God is everywhere, right? God's infinite light is everywhere. So how are we suggesting?
For us, it's contracted. To our perception, our understanding, our interrelationship with it, it's, we don't feel it. We're not physically experiencing that light.
Okay, you're onto something. So let's just take a look quickly here at what a Kabbalist writes to describe this. Lou, would you like to read 2a for us, please, on page 145?
Those who wish to understand the Tzimtzum in a literal manner will be led to beliefs that contradict most of the fundamentals of our faith. First of all, we were explicitly taught, to whom do you compare God, and what likeness can you arrange for him? If, however, you take the Tzimtzum literally, you are indeed imposing an image on God, an encompassing circle, an empty space, and a straight channel within that space.
Thank you. So what's he saying? What he's telling us is that you can't suggest, or if you're going to suggest, that this Tzimtzum, that this contraction is literal, that God actually removed himself from the space, you're going to have some big issues with a lot of fundamentals of Judaism if you're going to say that he removed himself. Because you can't say, what's the verse we quoted? To whom do you compare God, and what likeness can you arrange for him? You could say that about a glass of water. You can't suggest that about God. So the bottom line is, what he says is that we have to view this as non-literal, which means that we have to take a more sophisticated approach when we talk about this contraction when we talk about Tzimtzum. So the infinite light always remained infinite, and it's everywhere. If God's infinite light is truly infinite, then there isn't anywhere that it isn't. We can't say that he removed it out of the space and now it's not here, because that doesn't jive with the fundamentals of Jewish belief. Because then we're limiting God. We're saying he's in some places, yes, and other places not. And that's a non-starter. So the question is, how do we make sense of this? We're saying on one hand, reality within reality, space was made for these limited worlds, which they couldn't have come about before. But at the same time, we cannot suggest that God's infinite light is gone. It wasn't removed, but somehow something did happen here nonetheless, which made it possible to go from the infinite to the finite. But it's certainly not, we outruled that God's infinite light was removed from here. We cannot say that. So we have to figure out what it does mean. But first, you have...
Well, just for us humans to understand, when a muscle contracts, the muscle's there. It's just smaller or taking up less space. Is that the case?
Well, less space, okay, but if it's infinite, it doesn't...
Muscles are not...
That's finite. Yeah, exactly. If something's infinite, it's not less or more. It's everywhere.
Right.
In the same way. Otherwise, it's not infinite.
When God is Mistar, he's there. He's just not visible to... not for our eyes to see at the moment. You know, not for us to recognize.
Okay. We'll develop this a little more. Thank you. You wanted to...
No. I was thinking about if something is concentrated, then the essence is there. It's just concentrated.
Maybe there's something to that as well. So let's see. Let's move along here. Let's read text number 3. What was your first name again?
In English, Jane.
Janie?
Jane.
Yeah. Okay. No problem. We can pass the microphone to the next person. Lynn, if you're okay reading text number 3, please.
Sir. Number 3. The Tzitzum does not mean that God's infinite light departed, God forbid, for in truth there is no place devoid of him. This principle is also expressed in the Midrash. Why did God choose to reveal himself to Moses from within a thorn bush? To teach that there is no place devoid of God's presence, even in a thorn bush. Instead, in this context, the meaning of Tzitzum is that Or Ein Sof went from a state of revelation to one of concealment without actually departing at all.
Thank you. So, what some of you I think were alluding to was this idea. When we say that God removed himself, we don't mean that he removed himself and now he's not here. What we do mean to say is that he hasn't gone anywhere. He's still here. But before, he was in a state of revelation, and then he concealed himself. He didn't go anywhere. He's just concealed. And we'll develop this idea so we can wrap our minds around it. In other words, if you want to look at this whole process of what happened here, right? So what's happening? Again, God's first, his infinite light fills the entire reality. And how do you end up with the possibility of worlds that are limited? So what happens is like this. You have the divine light that filled all of reality that was before everything. Before Genesis, God's infinite light was everywhere. What does that mean? We're going to sum it up in the terms that we're using here. It means his presence was revealed in all of reality, wherever you turned. Infinite light overwhelmed it all. There was no space for anything else. The next thing that happened was God contracted it. What does that mean? It means that he concealed it. He didn't remove it. He just became concealed. He became hidden. Again, we're talking about something spiritual here, about something physical. We wouldn't be able to say that it's there, but you don't see it. If it's there, if the table's here, we can see it. If we don't see it, it means it's not here. But we're talking about God's, of course, spiritual presence. and divine light. So he didn't leave anywhere. He's there, but concealed. And then what happens next? Then God projected a single straight line, which means a minor revelation. So the full intensity of his infinite light, he concealed. That's step number one, to make room for worlds. Step number two is, he then unleashed a projection, meaning a minor projection or a minor revelation, in order to allow the activation of this system of worlds. To sum it up in three words, revelation, concealment, and then another minor revelation. Revealed, concealed, and then a little revealed. Yes?
This is for, it's a child or someone, but you'll appreciate this. You know when you have a child playing peekaboo, and a child see, children don't understand, you hide behind a blanket, or where did mommy go, right? It's the same thing. I mean, we're on that simple level, like a child.
Exactly. So he remains, but we don't see him. Why is that? How is that possible? Because he didn't go anywhere. He's just concealed. Now, so far everyone's with me, right? So the question is, how do we like understand this a little bit more? So in order to kind of develop the idea and appreciate it like intellectually, not just with words, we're going to return to a parable that we used earlier on, and that was the one of Sir Isaac Newton, right? This brilliant scientist. And in other words, we're going to use the teacher-student parable that we spoke about already earlier, and we're going to revisit it. So just to, but we're going to, it's not going to be exactly the way we said it last time. We're going to kind of develop it a little more. So we started with this issue. Brilliant scientist, and he wants to go give a talk to some teenagers. Now, for him to go share his full-on, the full-on depth of his theories, he'd be wasting his time. The high schoolers are not going to know what he's talking about. They're going to get nothing. They're not going to get a little. They're going to get zero. So what does he do? He has to somehow, through hard work, he has to look at the depth of his big ideas, and he needs to identify something within his big theories. He needs to identify something small that he could extract from it, and what he does extract, he'll be able, hopefully, to convey to these teenagers. Okay? So, what's the issue here? He has to put in a lot of work. He has to think long and hard in order to do that, in order to separate something small and relatable, to extract it from the big idea. After he does it, it's still part of his big idea. It's a minor part of it, but it's still part of it. The question, though, is, if this small idea is an offshoot of the big idea, why did it take so much work in order to figure out or identify it within his big theory? Right? Why does it take so much work? If it's just part of it, then it's part of it. It shouldn't be so complex to figure out. The reason for that is because by default, the minor implication that he's going to convey to these teenagers, by default, it's part of the big idea. The big idea is way too complex for them. This minor implication, without him putting in the work to extract it from it, it's just overwhelmed by the big idea. So without putting in the work to identify it and kind of give it definition on its own, independent of the big theory, he won't be able to communicate it to these teenagers. So what does he do? What he needs to do, the teacher, the scientist, in order to identify this idea that he will be able to convey, he needs to really, so to speak, forget his big idea. he needs to take the full depth of his theory and he needs to like put it aside in a back burner. That's where he needs to put in his work. His work needs to be focused on, so to speak, forgetting the big idea and then trying to extract, and then he'll be able to identify something small from the big idea. As long as, let's just say he's talking to his colleagues who are able to relate to his big theories, then he doesn't have to put in work to try to extract and identify details or small ideas from it. He just reveals. You just reveal, reveal, reveal. You just spill out everything you have, and they'll understand you. They're on the same page as you, and you're just revealing. But if this teacher wants to reveal something to the teenager, he first has to undergo a tzimtzum. He can't just go from talking to his colleagues with his whole big ideas and then shift and then try to give something from that to these other students. He needs to first remove the awareness of the big ideas. In other words, he has to conceal. After he conceals, then he could identify and extract and project something small that he will be able to convey to those teenagers. Are you getting the drift? How one reflects the other? So we have, of course, the analogy here with Newton and his students and his teenage students, very similar, and this kind of helps us illustrate the idea of what needed to happen in order to go from the infinite to the finite. Let's read it in the source from the fifth Chabad Rebbe, known as the Maimonides of Hasidic philosophy, because his works were so expansive and orderly, etc. I'm going to ask Larry to please read 4a for us.
Consider the example of a teacher imparting information to students. The profound concept the teacher understands is incompatible with the student's mental abilities. True, the profound concepts contain less significant elements that are compatible with the student's minds. Nevertheless, in the teacher's mind, these elements are filled with the profundity of the overall concept, and they therefore remain too deep to deliver to the students. The main obstacle here is that there is no distinction in the teacher's mind between the core of the concept and its less significant elements. Consequently, if the teacher proceeds to transmit this knowledge to the students, the teacher will deliver the full profundity along with the less significant components. Students will understand none of it. The solution is for the teacher to conceal the entire concept, mentally pushing the whole idea aside to approach it anew. The teacher can now distinguish between the idea's core and the more superficial elements. The teacher can then deliver the transmittable details without flooding these elements with the overwhelming complexity of the core concept.
Thank you. So the key component, the key factor here is that the teacher needs to lose awareness of the big idea, and that enables him to discover the minor implication that he actually wants to convey. Let us just go to the screen to kind of summarize what we have here, and it will help summarize it for us. So we're going to focus on the parable side of things first. A genius has an abstract idea that's beyond ordinary students. That's the beginning. Okay? We're not going to articulate it yet, but you can already in your own mind think of what that corresponds to on the other side. And then we have the abstract idea has a minor implication that is relatable. So that the big idea does contain a small idea. It's not, you can't identify it yet, but it's in there. The small idea is somewhere within the big idea. This minor implication is still part of the unattainable idea. The abstract idea is removed from the genius's conscious thinking. Okay, so now he walks into the classroom with the teenagers, and he's like, what am I going to give them? So he says, you know what, give me a couple minutes. And the first thing he needs to do is tzimtzum. He needs to the abstract idea needs to be removed from his conscious thinking. Otherwise, the big idea overwhelms his whole awareness. He can't identify something small to give them. So he needs to remove all that. And then the minor implication becomes discoverable and can be shared. Okay? So now let's see if we can go to the analog. Yes?
The abstract idea, God doesn't have problems with any of this. He's London with Simpson. The abstract idea is put aside.
In other words, concealed.
Yes, right. Not removed. It's never removed.
Not removed, like spatially. No,
right.
It means that it's concealed. Instead of being revealed and overwhelming everything, it needs to be.
Right.
Just like in the mind of the genius, he doesn't remove anything physically, but he needs to kind of put it on a back burner within his mind.
So that he can pick out what the student can handle.
Yes, yes. Now let's go to the analog side. And what's the starting point? An infinite light filled all of reality with no room for a finite expression. Okay, we're still like unpacking that big text from the Arizal, right? That original text. Now we're starting to understand it. We can like reread it now and it actually makes some sense. So it starts with the infinite light filling all of reality with no room for a finite expression. God's infinity includes the power to be finite. Now even when God is infinite, before he does any tzimtzum, the capacity for finitude is within God. You can't say that God is infinite and not finite, right? If God can't be finite, then he's not infinite. Infinity means that he can be infinite. He can also choose to be finite. So it's there within his infinite light. The ability to be finite is there too, but it's not identifiable because it's all overwhelmed by infinity. So what happens next? This power to be finite is still part of divine infinity. We said that already. Next thing is God concealed his infinite light, and then God projected his finite power into the space of concealment. So he conceals the full intensity of the infinite light, and then he unleashes a more finite boost of energy. Over here we're calling it that line, that projection, and that's what makes it possible for there to begin this process of worlds coming into being, definition of Atzilut, followed by the three worlds of Biyah. Before that, it wasn't possible.
At Har Sinai, an example of this is people couldn't handle the great light from God when he
Correct. At Sinai, it said that God's that those who were present, their souls expired because of the intensity of the moment, of the experience. And then after that, Moses was the one that communicated onward so that they wouldn't, so to speak, lose themselves as a result. Is this making sense? Yeah? But it made sense, right? Okay, just making sure. I'm just going to give you one more illustration for this to make it a little bit more relatable. Okay, say that you never went to Israel till you were, I don't know, 65 years old. Let's just say you're going for the first time and you always wanted to go. It sounds like you were never interested. You were. You wanted to go, just never panned out, and now you're there, and you go to Jerusalem, and you go to visit the Western Wall, and you're having like an out-of-body spiritual experience, and you feel so moved by the power of this of the space that you're in, and let's just say that you, before that, you weren't yet Shabbat observant, and at the Wall you say, you know what, and you make a pledge to God, I'm going to start observing Shabbat, and I'm going to give more charity, and I'm going to attend more JLI classes, and I'm going to go to synagogue. And it's a beyond experience. And then you're on your way back to your hotel, and a few minutes later at your hotel, maybe somebody in your group, maybe there was also someone not Jewish in your group, and he sees you, and you're like totally visibly shaken and moved. And he's like, what's going on? and you respond and say, I just had this amazing, unbelievable, life-changing, life-altering experience. Now, did he get anything from you just now?
No.
He got nothing. All he knows now is that you had a very inspiring experience, and that's why you're moved. He doesn't have anything yet. So you pause for a moment, and you try to, like, put aside your out-of-body inspiration that you're experiencing right now, and you say, not necessarily is he noticing that this is going on internally, but internally, for a quick moment, you're like, let me put that aside, let me make this a little more relatable. So then you tell him, I just came from the space where the binding of Isaac took place. I came from the space where the two temples stood, the first temple, the second temple. And then we were exiled from here. So this place is a reminder of the exile that we're in. It's also a reminder of our hopes for the future, to be returned to Israel with our righteous Messiah. What did you just do? Now he's starting to understand you. You're starting to tell him what's unique about this place that you just visited. So on one hand, you just broke it down to details, and it's totally removed from your out-of-body experience that you had and that you tried to describe but failed. Now you're giving him details about the space that you just went to. And even though it's very removed, but it's also very much part of it, because you're describing all these things are true about the space that you just came from. So he's getting something, but he's certainly not getting the depth of your experience. So does this make a little more sense? So first is the overwhelmed reaction, which he's not able to relate to. Then you extract from that some details about the space you were just at, and that he starts to understand. Does he get the full intensity of it? And why all those bits of information, why that made you have an out-of-body spiritual experience? No, not necessarily, because he wouldn't be able to relate to that. So that's the idea, and that's what Tzimtzum, and that's what this process really is all about. So this is we're beginning to answer our question of how we went from infinity to finite. It's due to the process called Tzimtzum. And this is how we described it. It's not that God is leaving the space. He's not removing himself. He's there as he was before, but he's just concealed instead of revealed. And because he's concealed, that's why he's able to reveal and make space for the world. Good? Okay. So now, a little bit more before we go to... the next phase. One more piece of information within the Tzimtzum world is that there is, if you remember, we said before, we called this Tzimtzum, this contraction, we called it the first. If you remember, that's actually how it's referred to. When you talk about this big shift, this is like the original Tzimtzum. That's how it's referred to. Because there are many others. Between every level, as you devolve through this system, there's more and more contraction. But there's a very big difference, a fundamental difference between this one and the other ones that may follow afterwards. What is that? So first of all, in term, this one is called a Tzimtzum. Let me see if we can find this on... Should we watch the video or...
Welcome to our fifth video on the world of Kabbalah, a journey through the mystical layers of the Kabbalistic system. We previously described the disparity between God's infinite light and the ten sfirot of Atzilut that have definitions and distinctions, and therefore limitations. How can absolute infinite divinity give way to a finite form of divinity, the ten sfirot? The transition cannot be gradual because it's impossible for infinity to devolve into something finite. So what enabled such a drastic leap? The good news is that 16th century Rabbi Yitzhak Luria explained this puzzle. The bad news is that it's a complex topic, So we'll just give a sample here. The idea is called Tzimtzum, which means contraction. God contracted his infinite light, disrupting its infinity to support the emergence of the finite spherot. The Kabbalists used metaphoric imagery. God pushed aside the light to form an empty void, into which he beamed the single straight light of illumination that evolved into the cosmos. Now, if that's not mysterious, nothing is. So let's clarify. The Tzimtzum did not remove God from anywhere or anything. So what did it achieve? Well, if you recall, in an earlier video, we described a scientist struggling to share an abstract, complex theory with teenage minds. He's forced to pause and rethink his presentation. After identifying a relatable detail within the theory, he shares just that detail with the students, who are blown away at the genius of it. It took the scientist time and effort to identify the detail. Why is that? Because the detail was lost in the forest of the complex theory. It didn't have its own identity. So how did he identify it? He stopped focusing on the theory. The idea remained in his mind, but he decreased the intensity of his focus, which created the mental space to hone in on a minor detail. That's the Tzimtzum. Nothing is impossible for God. He has both the ability to be infinite and to be finite. The difference is that his infinity is naturally revealed. That's the infinite light. While his ability to be finite is lost in the background, like the scientific detail overlooked in the context of a complex theory. Just as the scientist reduced his focus on the entire theory to allow a detail to become visible, so did God reduce the focus on his infinite power to allow his finite power to operate. So when the Kabbalists say that God made an empty space for creation, it's not actual space and it's not actually empty. It's a shift between two layers of divine focus. And when they talk of a single straight line, they mean God's ability to be finite, which is what allowed the ten spherot, finite forms of divinity, to emerge. How is that relevant to us? We exist thanks to the process of Tzimtzum. But the Tzimtzum is not a true withdrawal, just a concealment of focus. So even when we feel that God is withdrawn from our world, it pays to remember that we remain within God's infinite light, although it's concealed from our perception. Knowing that makes it easier to personally relate to God. And the fact that God initiated this drastic step of Tzimtzum to make space for our existence should inspire us to create space for His presence in our lives. After all, it's just a matter of focus.
Helpful? Okay. One more little detail within this conversation, and that is that, let's see, what do we have here? Okay, so what we spoke about up until now was the first original Tzimtzum, which we said was like above there. None of these emanations could happen without that first Tzimtzum. First, God needed to unleash the ability to be finite, and then these 10 faculties in Atzilut, as you could see, came about. But then you have another thing here. In between the world of Atzilut, for a step down into the worlds of Biah, that's a big degradation. It's a big step down to go, even though Atzilut is already emanation and specific. To go from there to Bria, Bria means creation. That's like a whole new world. That's like much lower. So what happens in order to make this happen? So there is something else here. You see, it's called a parsa. Something else happens in between in order for this transition to happen. Not nearly as radical as the original Tzimtzum in order to go from infinity to Atzilut. That is radical, the biggest one. That's why it's called the original tzimtzum. All other tzimtzums pale in comparison, but yet there's still a need for some additional transitions. But at other phases or other, let's just say, mile markers. So what happens over here? Over here, we don't just say there's another tzimtzum. We actually give it a different name. It's called parsa. Why parsa? So I'll explain you the difference in very short. How did this transition take place? Here's the difference. When you have light, let's just say sunlight's coming into the house, and you close the, and you put a curtain over it. So there's a lot less light now. But what's the difference? The light that now exists in your house with a closed curtain, it's like a new entity. It's a new kind of light. It's still light coming from the sun, but the curtain causes it to be a different quality of light. Again, it's still light coming from that same source. It's coming from the sun, but when you close the curtain, it gives birth to a new type of light. That's like the transition from Atzilut to Bria. However, that's unlike, say for example, if you have a crack. Let's just say you have a crack in a wall, and some light is coming in. That's a different story. It's much less light when you have light coming through a crack versus a very large opening. It's a lot less, but it's the same quality. It's the original quality of the light. It's just very little. However, when it comes through a curtain, it's a new type of light that was just given birth to. It's filtered, exactly, as opposed to here, where it's very little, but it's still the original. So that's why they have different names, because something different is happening. What we were saying until now is when we say contraction, when we say tzimtzum, it's a lot less, but it's of the original. When we say parsa, that changes the quality of it totally. It's a filtered light, it's a different story. There's more on this, but we're not going to dwell on it because I do want to advance. Yes?
The word parsing. It's like parsing. It's the same Shorish as the...
Parsi as in?
When you're learning Torah and they parse, maybe not.
What's the context? I mean...
The word. What's...
Parsa, it could mean a curtain. It could mean to spread, like ufros alenu. You know, it's like the same word. So when you say curtain, you're like spreading a curtain over.
Why isn't it parochet?
Parochet, yeah. But when you parse, when you're studying Torah, and you're part, am I saying it right?
Which word?
The word parse. When you're
parsa.
She's thinking about parshas.
Parsha. That's
no,
a shin.
Not parsha, no.
That's a shin, this is a samach.
Right, okay.
So it's different. Parochet is... It's similar. I mean, it also means a curtain, but still a different word. I mean, I guess that's biblical.
I thought pars related to...
Pras could also mean like reward in the Mishnah. Amenas lekabel pras. But whatever, that's the word for curtain, and that's just for the contrast between that and the contraction. All right, let's advance a little bit and bring this all home and make it a little personal for the remaining time that we have today. But nothing goes like it does with a joke. So, just to bring everyone's attention back in here, after flying high in the contractions. So, this guy went on a date for the first time. He met this girl, and he realizes that, you know, a lot of time just passed. An hour and a half passed already. He realizes that he's been talking about himself for the last hour and a half. So he says to her, "You know what? Wow, I've been talking about myself for the last 90 minutes. I want to give you a chance to talk. So tell me, what do you think about me?" So here's the deal. There's two ideas that we're going to be extracting from this tzimtzum discussion to make it personal. The first one is that let's talk about the pre-tzimtzum reality. In general, by the way, the Talmud teaches that one should go about their life emulating God. There's a whole list in the Talmud, in the tractate Sota. It says that God clothed the naked, so shall you. God fed the hungry, or feeds the hungry, so shall we. God visited the sick. He came to see Abraham right after his bris, so shall we. God buried the dead, Moses, and we should do the same. There's a whole list of things. In general, we should emulate God. But there's one area where we absolutely shouldn't. And that is God's reality, the way he was pre-Tzimtzum, where God's infinite light filled the entire space and gave room for no one and nothing else. That is something not to emulate. Because it's possible, and I'm sure we can all relate to this, maybe a little bit ourselves, and certainly with people that we encounter or engage with. There are times when people are very self-absorbed. If they're not talking about themselves, they want to hear other people talking about themselves. But the problem, the result with that is that they fill the space entirely and don't give room for anybody else. If they're infinite light or finite light, but if they fill the entire space, then there's no room for anybody else. And this is a problem that's not so uncommon. So let's see what the Rebbes have to say about this. Where are we? Jake, want to please help us with text 6a. Thank you.
Those who are self-obsessed and narcissistic become engrossed in their desires and wishes and completely forget about God. Similarly, their self-obsession precludes loving others. Their self-love generates divisiveness because it doesn't allow them to tolerate others. They think that whatever someone else says or does is directed against them. There was an incident that well illustrates this point. A fellow who happened to be a tremendous scholar and well versed in Torah once had a private audience with my great-grandfather, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Lubavitch. Rebbe, he complained, the others are stepping all over me in the study hall. They do not appreciate what I have to say. They do not behave properly towards me, and they do almost the exact opposite of my opinion. The holy Rebbe replied, your ego expands throughout the entire study hall. Wherever anyone steps, it is bound to be on you.
So he's complaining that everyone's stepping on him. It may just be that you're putting yourself everywhere. So wherever someone is stepping, you think it's on you. If you stick and mind your own business and don't interfere with everybody's life, you're not going to find people stepping on you. So this happens when someone is overly present and pushing their opinions, their feelings, desires into places, into people where they don't necessarily belong. This is true. This could be about colleagues in the work in the workforce. It could be about a manager who micromanages those who work with them. Maybe a family member. All of these are possible. And the important teaching here is that as long as we are steeped in ourselves and our own desires and our own perspectives, we'll never be able to make space for other people. And by the way, you may have noticed that this is not necessarily being said about someone who's like, you know, a low life, good for nothing. This happened to a Torah scholar, someone who was a person of caliber. But yet, he still was self-absorbed. Just because he knows a lot of Torah doesn't mean that he's humble, doesn't mean he's selfless, doesn't mean he knows how to experience an internal tzimtzum. So the key idea here is that we should not be like a pre-Tzimtzum reality where the infinite light of God was filled the entire space. If that's how we behave, it's not going to end very well for us. So what we need to do is Tzimtzum. We have to practice contraction. We have to conceal, or we have to step back, and we have to know our place. We have to know our role. And, you know, this is true, not in my case, present company excluded, but there's a concept called a mother-in-law. And what's the problem? A mother-in-law is so used to showering her kids with love, and that when there's a son or daughter-in-law that come into the picture, so it has to extend to them too. The problem is that not always is it appreciated. as Esty's neighbor in Brooklyn, she has the woman that lives across the hall. She says, I learned how to be a good mother-in-law. I opened my pocketbook and I shut my mouth. That's a good mother-in-law. Take it from Mrs. Zavdi in Brooklyn, New York. So that's the key. The key is internal work. It's called avoda in Hasidic parlance, which means, let me see if that slide is here. I don't know. Yeah, it is, right there. Working to enhance one's character and to become more aware of God, often facilitated by immersive prayer. So it's called avoda. Literally, it means work. It means toil. It's not an easy feat to be able to contract oneself and contract one's ego. If it was so easy, more people would do it. But we're always encountering people who struggle with it because it isn't so easy. But if we spend time putting in work, whether it's Torah study, prayer, and we could identify more with God, and then we can diminish ego. I think I already mentioned once recently that ego stands for edging God out. The more ego, the less God. The more God, the less we view ourselves as so essential to the reality around us. This idea also applies to another concept, that we need to make space for God, but it goes beyond that, and that is that we need to reciprocate what God does for us. Just like God was very, God was likely happy. I mean, maybe something was missing, obviously, otherwise he wouldn't have bothered creating the world. But in order to create the world, what did he do? He had to contract his infinite light. He had to do that in order to create worlds. And what was the ultimate after all these worlds he created? He created us. That's the ultimate creation that he put this whole business into motion for. So in order to create us, he contracted himself. That should inspire us to reciprocate in kind. As it says, I'm not going to read the whole text here, but in text 7, we quote a verse that kamayim apanim al apanim means that when you look into water, you see your face reflecting back at you. So when you look at God and you see what God does for you and contracted his own being, his own reality, in order to create you, then that should, that should inspire us to do the same and make more time and space for God in our life by contracting our own needs, our own desires, our own priorities to make more space for God in our life. So, look, people always want to do the right thing. People always tell me, I would love to come to synagogue, but I don't have time. I would love to do X, Y, and Z, but I don't have money. All these things take work for someone to part with their money for God, for a charitable cause, for somebody to make more time in their schedule for God, whether prayer, whether study, whether volunteering. All these things mean that we have to undergo tzimtzum. We have to conceal and contract our own priorities in order to make time and space for God's ideas. That is all one big idea takeaway from tzimtzum, that we need to contract ourselves and our own egos in order to make space for God and to be appreciated by the reality around us. Yes, Michael.
This ties in, I see, with what we discussed last week, where if we do something for someone, we shouldn't expect something back. I mean, it should come naturally from us without any expectation that we're doing it because we'll get something back.
Yeah, look, it all boils down to selflessness, right? Anything we learn about God, or any Torah that we learn, certainly within the Kabbalistic ideas, the whole point is that it should lead us more godly, is less selfish, more selfless. So yes, you will find this idea. It's a common idea when you study any of these related concepts. So, taming the ego, if we find ourselves taking up all available space, a self-imposed tzimtzum is warranted. We'll provide space for others to thrive around us and allow God into our lives. Final big idea for tonight, and that is, the question is, what's the first divine move we call an act geared toward creation? What's the first thing that God did? God wanted to create. What's the first thing he did? Stepped back. Right? Everything we discussed for the last hour. Tzimtzum. The first thing that he did when he wanted to create was concealment. That was step number one. He couldn't make a move as far as in pursuing creation without first concealing. And this is a huge idea. So, what does this mean? First of all, we have to understand. Yes? We have to understand what this means. Concealment wasn't an end in itself. It's very important to remember this. Key idea. This darkness that God created through contraction, through tzimtzum, wasn't for the sake of darkness. It was just a means to an end. It had a very specific purpose. The darkness was there, was created to allow for revelation, to allow for that projection of light that followed. The darkness was for the purpose of revelation. Darkness doesn't have an independent purpose or value in its own right. It's only there because it precedes revelation. Now, this teaches us that this pattern of darkness then light has a lot more. It actualizes itself. It manifests itself in many different layers, in many different ways. From the original Tzimtzum, which was for the sake of revelation, the same pattern plays itself out in many, many different levels. That first comes darkness, and then comes light. First of all, we all know, anyone who follows the Jewish calendar or observes Shabbat, even to any degree, we all know that Shabbat starts at sunset in the evening, right? Even though the seventh day is the seventh day, but it starts at night. And that's true about everything. It's true about every night. Today was the 14th day of Kislev. Tomorrow is the 15th. But once the sun sets, the 14th day is over. And the 15th day begins. So, this is true within Jewish law. It's always this way. But the question is why? I mean, it's a cute idea, but why halachically? Why from the perspective of Jewish law does the day start at night? What's the idea? Number one. Number two, why is every unit of a day consist of a night and a day? Why do you have to have 7 units in a week, each one having a day and a night? Have 14 units, 7 units of darkness, 7 units of light. Why does each one consist of both darkness and light? And the answer is that all of this is a reflection of everything we've been discussing tonight. It's all a reflection of the first contraction, the first reality of darkness, where it was there just in order to introduce light afterwards. They weren't two independent things. The darkness was created so that we can have light. It's a very important thing to remember. God, again, in our human terms, wanted to create. The first thing he did was create darkness so that he can create, so that he can project light. Not first darkness and then let's see what to do next. No, it was very clear what the purpose was. Darkness for the sake of light. And this is why we know in the Torah, in the beginning, what happened first? We quoted those verses already in an earlier class. We talked about darkness. In the very beginning, it was tohu vavohu, chaos and desolate. And it was darkness covering the earth, tehom in the Hebrew. So the same thing. And then what happened? And God said, let there be light. Darkness, then light. And again, as we read on Simchas Torah and in Bereshit, at the end of each day's creation, and there was evening and there was morning. 1 day, 2 day, 3, etc. Same thing throughout. All of this is a manifestation and a reflection of the original darkness, which was followed by light. That was the idea in 8a. which we won't read, but this brings us back to the problem that we discussed in the beginning of this lesson. If you remember when we opened, we said that we're going to get some profound ideas from tonight's discussion on how we can go about finding strength to be able to overcome challenges when we are hit by challenges in life, and who over here isn't hit by challenges of one kind or another. And the question is, how do we face such challenges and not crumble in the face of adversity? What do we do? How do we stay resilient? So the answer is right here. Now we should be experts on this. We're in text 8b. Michael, if you're okay, please reading that one.
We observe the same pattern reflected in the affairs of the world, whereby individuals do not achieve growth in wealth, leadership, building a family, study, or any other accomplishment without first experiencing humiliation, pain, loss, and the like. For example, individuals engaged in study will not arrive at a complete understanding of the subject without much toil and stress, feeling distant from understanding and tempted to despair from mastering the subject. Indeed, the Talmud states, one does not understand statements of Torah without first being mistaken. We observe the same in earning a livelihood, whereby we succeed only after putting forth great effort and enduring much pain, even feeling despair. Only thereafter do we find profit and great blessing. This is the way that God's blessings flow in the upper worlds and travel down to the lowest realm. There is no light without the darkness that precedes it. As it is stated, according to the pain is the reward.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So what do we have here? What we have here is that if we want to succeed in a given area of life, we have to be ready to experience some darkness before finding the light. And if we aren't experiencing any struggle, if we are never failing, it's very possible that we have more potential for growth that's untapped into. Because if everything is good, that means we're not pursuing our next potential accomplishment in life. But when we start struggling with it and failing a little bit, that means that darkness is indicative of light that's awaiting us afterwards. And again, that is the story of our world. Concealment preceded light. And this is how it is in every area, of life, that first comes the darkness and then comes the light. The darkness of night is rooted in the tzimtzum. Everything originates in that same story. And the absence of struggle confirms greater potential for growth that's available for us. And one more idea, and before that actually, it's very clear what's happening now in the Jewish world. I think we can all relate to this very much, not just on a personal level, but also on a more national level as far as the Jewish people are concerned. So it's quite obvious that on October 7th, we all experienced a tremendous darkness. Obviously, for those who were directly impacted within Israel, within the south of Israel, goes without saying, but all of us are feeling the trauma. The entire Jewish world experienced this sense of darkness. But at the same time, it's also clear that this darkness gave birth to an unprecedented light that we have discovered within the Jewish people. We've been talking about it on various occasions since then. The unity among the Jewish people in Israel and everywhere is unprecedented. For real, it's not just things that sound good to be said. We're talking about politically, political divisions came crumbling down between different segments of levels of religiosity and observance, which in Israel have been historically very strong, have come crumbling down. People who weren't in the army before, now are. People who weren't interested in wearing tzitzit or tefillin before, now they are. And this is true not only in Israel, but all over the world. You hear this again and again, I'm sure you do, as much as I do. And this is the light hopefully it's only the beginning of the light, because we still have yet to see it's hard for us to say, in God's eyes maybe, it's hard for us to say that a certain measure of light was, God forbid, worthwhile the darkness that we experienced. That we could never say, because who are we to say that? But at least we still have yet to see the tremendous light that will result from the darkness that we experience. So that's true on every level. And finally, there's something called post-traumatic growth. It's an idea in psychology. And what does that mean? That sometimes when somebody goes through something, a certain dark experience in life, very often that leads them to a place of growth and a place of light in their own personal life, that they discover dimensions of their own self that they never came in contact with, they never discovered or met beforehand. Only because they went through a dark period in life, maybe a health issue, maybe a livelihood issue, maybe something in their family, and that leads them to discover a resilience and a sense of purpose, renewed purpose and mission in life that they perhaps would not have had beforehand. Again, it's the darkness that they're living through that's bringing them to that sense of light. So just to conclude with one thing that was said by the previous Rebbe, my namesake, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. So he led the movement in Russia. Eventually he came to New York in 1940. But he was leading the Chabad movement in Russia under communism. And he made a firm decision that even though they were after him to try to stop him from promoting Judaism, Torah, and Jewish observance, he made a firm decision that he will absolutely not follow their instructions. And not only that, he ran an underground network of Jewish synagogues, mikvahs, schools, which was unbelievable. I'm talking about hundreds of schools in the underground. It's volumes have been written on this. It's not for right now. But in 1927, he was arrested by the Soviets, and he actually was sentenced to death due to heavy international pressure. It was changed first to 3 years in exile, and eventually he was kept on getting shorter and shorter, and within a few weeks he was released on the 12th day of Tammuz, about 3 weeks after his arrest, almost 4 weeks. So what are you saying here? He went through a very, very difficult time during those 4 weeks. He actually was tortured. He literally came out broken physically. He was beaten and tortured. Again, he himself wrote an unbelievable diary, and many volumes have been written on this. But afterwards, he expressed himself as follows. Let's go to the screen for this one. So adversity often leads to a renewed sense of purpose. This is what he said. If someone would offer to sell me a single moment of additional suffering for $1 billion, I would not buy it. If someone would offer to purchase a single moment of my past suffering for $1 billion, I would not sell it. I wouldn't want another minute of it, but I wouldn't give away even a minute of suffering that I did experience. Why is that? Because he realized that the darkness that he experienced brought an additional increased measure of light into his life, and a sense of purpose, a sense of mission. With his brokenness, he ended up going to the United States in 1940 and led the movement in America, which is another whole set of mishigas. The communists are one thing. Coming to America was another whole world, which he had to adapt to, where, again, it's not the time and place, but he declared that America is no different, and we're going to recreate Judaism here just like it was in the old country. And goes without saying that he succeeded. But he led the movement for 10 years till 1950. And the point is he was able to identify the incredible light that he discovered within himself after it, that he wouldn't trade even one drop in for anything. So let's all try to take these two big ideas to heart and see to it that this tzimtzum should not remain just one that was original when God created the world, but it should be something that we all take in and internalize as we go about living our day-to-day life. Thank you very much for joining. Lesson 6 next Monday evening at 7:30.
Thank you.